morning, everyone. Can you believe that Christmas is just 3 short days away? That is a subtle hint for anyone who hasn't begun their Christmas shopping quite yet to maybe get on that today, all right? But besides the presents, this time of year is a time in which many of us have very special traditions that we live into with our families. Special traditions like coming to a Christmas Eve candlelight service, which is a gentle reminder not to miss out on that this year. Remember, we'll be 3 and 5 right here at the Greenwood campus on Tuesday night. But besides that, I'm a little bit curious. What are some of these special traditions that you and your family have? You know, do you bake up a special batch of cookies or sing a special song? Is there some special place that you go to or some special movie that you watch at your house? I want to take just a second and let you all share a little bit about this with one another. So if you would, turn to someone around you and share the answer to this question. What is the most special Christmas tradition that happens in your household? All right. Go. All right. Sounds like a really good conversation going on. I heard some nervous laughter at the beginning, like, oh, I don't know if I can say this in church. Were there some of those? I don't know. But I'd like to hear from you guys. Somebody tell me, what's the most special tradition that you do in your home?
Cookies.
Cookies. What kind of cookies?
Chocolate chip.
Chocolate chip. You can't beat
a
chocolate chip cookie.
And cookie dough.
Oh, that's the best part. No doubt. All right. Someone else. All right, Christmas stockings, I heard somebody say. Is good stuff going in the stockings? All right. Like, what kind of things would you have in your stockings?
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, he knows what to put in there, huh? All right, I heard you say something here, Bill. Watch Charlie Brown Christmas. That's a good one, a classic for sure. Anybody else? Singing Christmas carols? It's watching It's a Wonderful Life? Yeah? One more. There you go. That's lots of families will sit down and read that. In my home, growing up, every Christmas Eve, we would come back from our grandmother's house, and we would all gather up in the living room. We'd turn off everything else in the house so that it would be in complete silence, and then we would just sit there in the glow of the lights of the Christmas tree, and together we would read the Christmas story. Sometimes we would read it from this storybook Bible that we had, but then many other years we would read the story from Scripture itself. We would read either the account that's in the Gospel of Luke or the account that's found in Matthew chapter 1, the passage of Scripture that we're going to focus on today. I was usually the designated reader in my home. I was the oldest child, and so that was my job. And whenever they would kind of let me choose what we were going to read, I would sometimes open up to the book of Matthew, but never, ever would I start with Matthew chapter 1, verse 1. Instead, there was this huge section of Scripture that I would just kind of like skip right over so that I could get to the good stuff, you know, the part about Mary and Joseph and baby Jesus. I'm going to guess that if you've opened up and you've begun to read Matthew, that this same section of Scripture is something that you've maybe just kind of skimmed through, that you might have breezed right on past, because what you find there at the very beginning of the book of Matthew is 17 very long verses of genealogy. 17 very long verses that recount Jesus's family tree, which has some pretty hard names thrown in there, I might say. But as you hear that, you might say, well, that sounds kind of interesting. But Matthew does it in this very, very methodical way. It kind of reads like this. So-and-so was the father of so-and-so, who was the father of so-and-so, who was the father of so-and-so. And so after a while, your eyes kind of like start to glaze over and your brain just totally checks out. But it's in there, isn't it? Matthew chose to include this genealogy. And not only did he choose to include it, he doesn't tuck it away in the back, right? He puts it right up front in this place of prominence, which tells us that all of these names, they must hold some sort of importance. But what is it, right? Why does Matthew launch into his gospel in this way? Well, I think part of the disconnect for us today, 2,000 years later, is that when we talk about genealogy, it's kind of something that we look into out of curiosity, that we just do for fun, right? Is there anybody here who has like an Ancestry.com subscription? There's Missy in the back. She's not ashamed. All right, here's a few more. You know, people get into it and they find out all these neat things. But in the time of Jesus, this wasn't something you did just for fun, okay? In the time of Jesus, your family tree was essentially the very same thing as your resume. So think about our resume today. On our resume, we put on there all of our education. We put on there all of our experiences, all of our achievements. It's this one document that we present that proves to the world that we are qualified to be or to do a certain thing, right? But in Jesus' day, those things that we list on there, they didn't really matter at all. Instead, what mattered most was your family lineage. Who you were descended from decided what you could ascend to. And so, for this reason, your family lineage was important, okay? Especially, not just to common folks, but especially to people who were royalty. In order to become king, you needed to be able to prove that you deserved to be there, that you had the right to rule, that you were qualified because of your family line. And so people like King Herod, who was ruling and reigning when Jesus was born, he would have known his family line. He would have celebrated his lineage. He would have told everyone about his ancestry that made him eligible to be in that place. And so when we open up the book of Matthew, we find the writer there doing essentially the same thing. He's laying out the qualifications for Jesus, for Jesus to be the Messiah, for Jesus to be the anointed one, for Jesus to be this king who had come to set up God's heavenly kingdom right here on earth. Matthew 1, verses 1 through 17 are Jesus's resume. And any first century Jew who would have opened this up, they would have been pretty impressed with what they saw there. They would have all agreed that it made a very, very compelling argument for Jesus to be king. First of all, his lineage starts out with Abraham himself, okay, which proves to everyone that he is indeed Jewish, that he was from this pure bloodline of Jewish forefathers, not from a family that had converted as Gentiles. And so this means that Jesus was the rightful inheritor of the promise that God had made to Abraham way back when, that through this family, all the other families on earth would be blessed. That was a solid start to proving Jesus's messiahship. However, on top of that, Jesus also has a very special person in his family line. He is a descendant of King David himself, the most celebrated and important great king in the history of the Jewish people. He's the one who slayed the giant Goliath and who would at some point unite the two kingdoms of Israel. The one who God had described as being a man after his own heart and who God had promised to send a descendant after him who would sit on his throne and rule and reign forever. The people of Israel, they have lived through defeat and exile and oppression, and so they are looking for this one. They're longing for this king, this son of David, to come. And as Matthew opens up his gospel, what he does is draw a straight line from David to Jesus to make his point clear. Jesus is this hoped-for one. But let me ask you a question. We've all probably made resumes, right? Have you ever lied on your resume? Research tells us that 85% of people lie on their resumes. But I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand because the research also tells us that 50% of people will never admit it. So we won't get into that. But, you know, when people are putting together their resume, sometimes they stretch the truth a little bit. And sometimes they stretch it a lot. Like this one woman who is currently sitting in jail in Australia because she made up her education, her work experiences, and she even posed as one of her references on a phone call. And all of this wasn't to land, like, you know, a normal office job, but to land this high-ranking job in the government. She even had gotten on LinkedIn, and she made her profile picture the supermodel Kate Upton. Do y'all know who she is? Because she was, like, trying really hard to make herself look extra good. You know, lies like those, they usually get caught. You know, they're kind of blatant and flagrant. So people often just make small little tweaks in their resume. You know, they'll say things that make their last job sound maybe a little more exciting than it was. Or they'll list out, you know, some duties that they may or may not have actually carried out. Or list a school that they were a few credits shy from graduating from. Or list this accomplishment, this award they received that sounds really neat, but no one knew it existed before because it doesn't, you know. But, you know, people will sometimes do those things. But much more often what people will do is they'll just kind of leave some things out, you know. Like, I'm not going to list that one job that really didn't go so well. Or I'm not going to put in there that one experience that I'm not so proud of. And the people in the ancient world, they'd actually do this very same thing in their family lineage. They would leave out in all the good parts, and they would leave out some of the more embarrassing ones. They would skip right over that ancestor that was a little crazy, or that family member who was a bit of a disappointment to everyone. King Herod himself, he actually did this. He had the help of the religious leaders of the day, and they, you know, just magically, mysteriously erased some people from his lineage. He didn't want to get into the sordid stories of the skeletons that were in his family's closet. But what's interesting about Jesus' family tree that we find there in Matthew is that these people that everyone else would have left out, Matthew chooses to leave in. In fact, he includes in this whole group of people who weren't usually mentioned in a person's genealogy at all because they weren't important. They didn't matter. Their presence had zero effect. And that was the group of women. But here in Jesus' lineage, we have five women who are mentioned. And each of them, as they're mentioned, they are caught up in various degrees in some sort of scandal. First, there's Tamar, a Gentile woman from Canaan who was married and her husband had passed away prematurely. And when her father-in-law refused to do what he was supposed to do to help her become remarried, then what she did was trick him. She posed as a prostitute. And she had her father-in-law be the person who fathered her child. And it was this child, Perez, who ends up in the Messianic line. So stop and think about that a little bit. There's a whole lot there in that situation. Next, there's Rahab. There's another Gentile, a foreigner from the hated Moabites. And she actually was a prostitute. And she mothered Boaz, the great-grandfather of King David. Then Boaz himself, he married another outsider, another Gentile named Ruth. Later comes the wife of Uriah, Bathsheba, who was an outsider, a Gentile, and her affair with King David would lead to him plotting and actually carrying out her husband's murder. And then finally we arrive to Mary, Jesus' own mother, who was the only one in the list who was actually a Jewish woman, but who still finds herself in a very difficult situation, being pregnant out of wedlock, something that would have put her on the outside of her own people. You know, you read through all that, and it's like, man, this is like a soap opera, isn't it? But Matthew, he's not embarrassed of this. He doesn't try to hide any of this away. He doesn't sweep it under the rug or try to make any of it disappear like Herod did. Instead, Matthew puts the dysfunction in Jesus' family on full display. And we might wonder, why? Why would he do such a thing? But it's to make a very important point that God has been using unexpected people in carrying out his story in the redemption of the world all along. When we look at these people being included there, you know, we might remember some of the stories as kids. People in the first century, once they were reading through it, they would have remembered these stories and it would have raised some eyebrows for them. These shocking people who are a part of Jesus' line. But honestly, I don't think that these people that we just mentioned are the most surprising people who are included there. Instead, the most surprising people, I think, are the people that are mixed in between the superstars in Jesus' family and the shockers. In between them, we find mixed in right there as a part of the story, all kinds of very ordinary people. Very ordinary people that we really don't know anything about at all. I mean, who here can tell me much about Hezron, Ram, Amminadab, and Nahshon? Anybody? Who in the world was Eliud and Eleazar and Mathon? You know, when we look back at the Old Testament, we don't have whole books written about these people. We don't even have whole chapters written about them. In fact, some of them are only mentioned in passing as being someone connected to someone else. They seemingly just move the family line along. But surprise, surprise, these are the very people who lead right up to the Messiah. And surprise, surprise, they're the very people who help lead right up to the most ordinary and unexpected, perhaps, of all in God's plan. Joseph, Jesus' own dad. There are only 16 verses in all of Scripture that mention Joseph by name. Okay, think about how big the Bible is. 16 verses in all. He's the man that God chooses to be Jesus' adopted father, but he is not a king. He is not a religious leader. He is not a scholar. He is not a wealthy benefactor. He is not anyone who's made a name for himself. Instead, Joseph is a tecton, a woodmaker, a furniture maker. He's not even an architecton, a master craftsman. Joseph was a humble carpenter. But can you imagine the impact that he must have had upon Jesus? Malcolm Gladwell, he has studied and written a little bit about second and third generation immigrant families. He was looking at them and he could see how they'd worked so hard and how they'd become highly educated, how they had gotten these wonderful jobs and how they were investing back, serving in their communities. But when he looked back at their parents and their grandparents, almost to a person, they were bakers and farmers and carpenters. And he said at some point as he was looking at all this, it clicked for him that these second and these third generations were becoming successful, not despite their humble backgrounds, but actually because of it. Consider how that might have been true for Jesus. Could it be that we radically underestimate the influence that Joseph had on his son? Imagine, just imagine how many hours that Jesus set by him being apprenticed as a carpenter. Imagine how Jesus' teachings were formed as he sat there learning at the carpenter's bench, working on a project side by side, being apprenticed not just in carpentry, but in life. Could it be that when Jesus teaches us about the prodigal son and the great love of his father who runs out to meet him, that Jesus has learned about God's love from his own earthly father as well? Or when Jesus teaches us to call God Abba, Daddy, that it's because he's had a great earthly daddy right here on this earth. We might think that Joseph isn't mentioned much because he's not that important. But might it be that he isn't mentioned much because he was just so ordinary that we missed it? That his influence is just so common that we take it for granted? As we continue in the story of Matthew, right past the genealogy, we come into the infancy narrative of Jesus. And there we discover that Jesus has a father who was merciful, compassionate, and forgiving. Joseph and Mary, they were already engaged to be married when he found out that she was pregnant. But what we need to understand is back in Jesus' time, being engaged was something much more formal, something much more official than it is today. It was this binding agreement between people. At the time of engagement was actually the time when the groom would exchange vows with his bride. It didn't happen in reverse. He was the one who made the vows. And at that point, they were legally considered to be husband and wife. And so here's Joseph. He has already made his vows to Mary. He's already promised that he's going to provide her with a home, with a living, and with love. He's already been paid the bride price by Mary's father. He's already paid a price to Mary herself. And their agreement, all of this has been witnessed by other people. And so this is a very serious relationship that they have entered into. It is one that at this point can only be terminated through one of two things: death or divorce. And so in this kind of binding relationship, unfaithfulness was a serious offense. It was considered adultery, something for which the law of Moses called for stoning to be the punishment for. It was a capital punishment. But by the time of Jesus, this wasn't really practiced anymore. And so instead, women were just kind of humiliated and received other forms of severe punishment. And Joseph, he would have been totally justified in inflicting such punishment on Mary. He could have taken her to court and ensured that her life would have never been the same. He could have shamed her. He could have ruined her in front of everyone. But what does Joseph choose to do instead? He decides to break off the engagement quietly.